Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. Thanks for joining us today. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
And we're really excited today to have a guest joining us as well, Tim Farron, MP. Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show. Would you mind by starting just quickly introducing yourself to those who haven't heard of you before?
Who am I? Well, I'm Tim Farron, and I am the Member of Parliament for Westmorland and Lonsdale, which, if that means anything to anybody, it is South Cumbria. It's the Lake District, bit of the Yorkshire Dales. Kendal is our big town. I've been the MP since 2005. I'm a Liberal Democrat. I was the party's president during our time in the coalition government and the party leader for the parliament just after that.
Brilliant. Well, we're really pleased to have you, such an experienced and interesting kind of Christian voice in parliament, in politics, to join us for this conversation. We wanted to start by talking about social media in politics. I don't know if you saw a story that was done by the BBC a few weeks ago, Tim, which was the kind of top line was that more than 3,000 offensive tweets are sent to UK members of parliament every day. This was an analysis of 3 million tweets aimed at MPs over a 6-week period, and it found that about 130,000, so that's 1 in 20, would be classified as toxic. Does that chime with your own experience? You're quite a kind of prominent on social media, shall I say, or a big user. Do you get inundated with kind of hateful, abusive messages?
It all depends. I think that women politicians get more grief than men. That definitely is the case, and indeed, people who belong to other minorities get grief as well. I think that it depends on what you mean by toxic. I mean, people saying things where they wildly disagree with you, using sometimes quite colourful language, is, would I call that toxic? It's not, you know, it's not a thing I'd like to do myself, but, you know, that's being challenged. Then there's stuff which is just downright abusive, and then there's the stuff that's violent. So, over the years, there have been tweets that I've received and other communications that the police have considered to be a direct threat. But I think that on a daily basis, I don't feel I get that. But I'm not a woman. I'm not a party leader these days, so I don't tend to cause quite the same amount of offence as I did and wind people up. But also, I kind of hope that as a having done it for a long time, and B, as a Christian, that it's not water off a duck's back at all, but that I may be able to just deal with it in a way which is relatively healthy, but that does not make it all right.
And why do you think politicians in particular have become such kind of an easy target for this? I mean, obviously social media can be quite toxic in other areas, but it seems like politics is a particularly kind of febrile, toxic atmosphere.
So the danger with all social media is that we live in bubbles and we think the bubble that we're in is the world, and it's not. Twitter is particularly attuned to people talking about, public events of one kind or another, you know, shared events, and politics right at the heart of it. And very often you'll talk critically, angrily about issues. And who are the people at the heart of those issues who are responsible for either sorting or not sorting out problems or causing problems. It's the political operators, the actors themselves. So I think it's kind of understandable that we would be at the center of things. But people who are, in high profile media personalities and the like, sports people, they also attract a level of sort of derision and attention, which is not always healthy. But it is a window on what it's like for a lot of young people in the social media that they use, and the scrutiny that I see in my life is kind of, in a microcosmic way, something that every 13, 14 year old in the country deals with in a smaller way. You know, when I was 13 or 14 or 15 or 16, and I made a fool of myself over a girl or whatever, like, six people knew about it and it was shameful or whatever, but I got through it. Now the world knows about it. And we're not built for that. So I potentially professionally am kind of, you know, have the resilience to a degree to deal with it. But the other people don't, and younger people especially don't. And we wonder why there's an epidemic of mental health problems in our society. You know, Andy Warhol said in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. He was way off. Everybody in the future, everyone's famous all the blinking time. And they're therefore a performer all the time, to be judged and to be scrutinized all the time, to be shamed all the time. So, you know, what I deal with is just what kids are dealing with all of the time now.
So, Tim, can I ask you, I'm really interested in this because you've been around a long time like me, and therefore you must have done your early political career long before social media existed. So what was it like then? I mean, how did communication with the great general public happen? Did you get sort of letters with green ink or?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so one of the things that I feel most blessed about in my political life was I joined the Liberals one day at sixth form in my first couple of weeks there. The guy who signed me up happily connected me with what I will call a bunch of little old Methodist liberal ladies from Leyland, who were the ones who ran with the local councillors and their team of helpers. And it was a way of life to these people, but serving people, you know, face to face, not just waiting for election time, but getting out and knocking on doors and listening to people, holding street stalls and all the rest of it. And the public were encouraged to get in touch with this, you know, band of local councillors and their helpers. And so there was that kind of face-to-face stuff, which I do a lot of still. You know, I will knock on doors every week somewhere, you know, often without asking how they're going to vote. We just want to know what they're thinking about issues. And so face-to-face is the best thing still. You know, people will apologise to me when they come up to me in the supermarket and tell me stuff or ask me things for doing so. And I say, look, if people stop doing this, then I've got something to worry about. And so the old school forms of communication were very, very effective and did the job. I think what social media does, in particular Twitter, but other things as well, they don't just let everybody's lives to be public, but everyone's a commentator. Everyone's an expert. Everyone has to have an opinion and share it. And so it encourages more of that. But generally speaking, I still deal with casework in a more direct way. So yes, electronic communications, but they're mostly by emails. And I think generally speaking, that's how people will get in touch. But no, we talk to each other. I think because of social media and because of online communications, I almost think that the old school ways of communicating, a bit of paper through a letterbox or someone standing on your doorstep, that makes them even more authentic and effective. So I try and do as much of that as I ever did.
I wonder whether you think that this kind of is inevitable, that when you gather a bunch of sinful, flawed human beings together onto a big international platform, there's nothing we can do to stop people ultimately saying horrible things to each other. Is this a problem of the kind of human heart, or are there things that the tech companies could do to do better? Is this a technology problem, or is it really about kind of character and sinfulness?
Well, if you had a pub and someone came into your pub, started using racist and offensive and, you know, just downright foul language, you have every right to kick them out. And so if someone comes into your internet pub, you own Twitter, for example, and they use offensive and unpleasant language and they just rude to people, you know, you might be right to give them a couple of warnings, but you are not being a fascist. You are not clamping down on free speech to say, you know, not in my gaff, mate. Off you go. And so I think that, yeah, I think the internet giants absolutely do need to get a grip. It's hard to police millions of people chattering at each other all the time in time. But I also think that for us as Christians, it is an opportunity for us to be gracious and to act differently. And I try to, and I sometimes fail.
I'm really interested in this at a sort of slightly more philosophical, theological level, because what you said before, that, you know, when you had a problem with your girlfriend, about six people knew about it. Now millions of people know about it. It says something. There's something about being human. The way we're created is that we're sort of embodied and physical, and that embodied physical nature actually acts as a limitation on what sin can do, on what, how far evil spreads. You know, if I say something really offensive to my friend, you know, it might go to a few people, but that's about it. But once you have this digital world, and you, it's like there's no, it's now not limited by the body. It's entered into this digital world, which means there's no limitation. This could go around the world. This, you know, something offensive said could impact literally billions of people. And that's just not the way the creation was meant to be. At least that's something I'm still sort of wrestling with, trying to get my head around. What does that mean? What do you think about that?
Well, look, I mean, the world is bigger in terms of people than it's ever been, and smaller than it's ever been, in a sense that, you know, you can say something here and it has an impact almost, or it may have an impact almost instantly on the other side of the world and affect millions of people. I think one of the other consequences is that it kind of devalues the discourse, because it's, there's so much of it that, you know, we always used to say, oh, don't worry, it'll be chip paper tomorrow about a bad headline in the newspapers. Well, it's, you know, it's like chip paper in 5 minutes. People have moved on to the next thing. What that tends to do is it increases people's, it lowers people's attention threshold, and it increases their tolerance threshold. And so, that won't get political too much, but you, an observation I would make in Western cultures, that political leaders now realize that if you can just, you know, refuse to take responsibility for a bad thing you have done for a few days, it'll just go away. Everyone will get outrage fatigue because there's something else to get excited about. And if you can stick that out, then you survive. And so I think it means it's harder for justice to get done as a consequence. Having said that, it also means it's harder to hide away. And so we live much more exposed lives than we used to. And the odd thing is that Christians are often, you know, accused of being judgmental. But the reality is we live in a society which is super duper duper judgmental, with no possibility of grace or redemption. You know, so again, if you're outed for having said a thing or done a thing or having in the past been a thing that, you know, contradicts the kind of culture of the moment, and maybe rightly contradicts it, maybe it is a bad thing that you've done, said or thought, or what have you. But the idea that you could be redeemed or forgiven or, you know, accepted, is alien. And then if anybody, you know, I would say from a liberal perspective, defends your right to have been and done and said that, or at least to offer the opportunity for them to have a second or third or fourth chance, then you are also cast out for defending the outcast. So I think that it's bizarre that a society that thinks it's irreligious is actually supremely religious and totally lacking in grace.
I'm really interested in your kind of perspective as a Christian and a liberal on this question, because, I mean, you mentioned that you're quite kind of in favor of more kind of regulation, moderation from the tech companies. But what do you feel about government intervention in this area? Because you'll be obviously aware that the government, the Conservative government here in the UK, has got an online safety bill, which has been in kind of going batting around for a few years. And one of the big questions is trying to force the tech companies to be more robust on stuff which is legal but harmful. What's your kind of position on that, both as a Christian and as a liberal? Do you worry about that kind of overreach, or do you think that's healthy in kind of curating the conversation?
Well, look, I think so the great thing about being a liberal is that there's not a fixed position. You've just got to make sure you're always skeptical about power and people who have it, including you, if you ever have it yourself. But also, let's remember that there are freedoms from and there are freedoms to. And people who will often call themselves classical liberals only have half the story. you know, so I should be free to do X, Y, and Z. Yes, yes, yes. But a comprehensive liberal, and I would say that I'm a comprehensive liberal and not a classical one, is to recognise that we also need to have freedoms from, you know, the libertarian position, if you like, and more than a classical liberal one, is to say I should be able to do whatever I like. And the more rounded liberal position is to say, yes, so long as it doesn't harm others. And then you've got to, then you've got a difficult judgment to make. It's easy to be a libertarian, anything goes. Easy to be an authoritarian, you know, you do what I tell you. It's more complicated to be a liberal, where you say, yeah, anything goes up until the point where it conflicts with someone else's rights. And then you've got to have a real hard think about it. And it's tough having to think about it, isn't it? And so, you know, and it involves a judgment call and being wise, but that is what it is to be human. So I think the principles underlying the online harms and online safety legislation the government is introducing are kind of right. I think that there's no doubt. So let's be honest, we're talking about some really wildly dangerous stuff, stuff that encourages, promotes, and gives how to when it comes to self-harm or worse. And it also means access to pornography, particularly for young people. And we shouldn't be squeamish about saying that pornography is deeply wrong and deeply harming. It dehumanizes people, doesn't matter whatever age you are. But particularly for young people, it means that you objectify, whether you mean to or not, those people to whom you are attracted, often normally, but not always, the opposite sex. And you will find that you therefore inadvertently see them as being less than human. They're only there for you and not for having dignity in their own right. And so the idea that it's prudish to care about pornography is for the birds. If you care about humans, you should think pornography is deeply degrading. And you may well say, well, I'm empowered to choose to take part in pornography myself if you are an actor in that. Yeah, but did you consult the rest of humankind, mankind, womankind? Did you consult them if it was all right with them that you've objectified all of them at the same time? Don't give me this freedom baloney. And so I think that, you know, where does the state step in? That's a tough one. And I think at the very least we step in and say, you know, you have to protect people who are under 18 from this kind of stuff, because it is deeply harming. It affects people's mind, it affects people's relationships, affects their mental health, it degrades the rest of humanity. And it's an area where I think Christians and feminists, for example, many of whom might not be Christians, have absolute common cause. And we need to reach and establish those common cause, because we believe in dignity, we believe in equality, we think exploitation is wrong, and we think this stuff is harmful.
Some Christians, as you'll be aware, find the whole kind of swamp of social media, you know, people attacking each other, passing around graphic images, death threats, is so kind of irredeemable that they just want to quit and kind of call time on the whole thing. You've obviously chosen to stay on Twitter despite all this. What's your position on that? Do you think that it could come to a point where this online world is so toxic that it's actually not wise for us as believers to take part?
Honestly, Christian or not, you're not missing anything. If you just log off, cancel your account, and, you know, just do other things in your life, you're not missing anything. And I think that's the danger. People think that they're missing out. A small number, but I am coming across increasing small numbers of young people who just decided, that's it. I'm not going to use this anymore. And going back to, we'll call old school texts and just that kind of, you know, more personal communications. So I'm not saying you should all log off, but please don't stress about it. If you find this is just too upsetting, distressing, taking up too much of your time, because it can become an idol, by the way, being on this all the time, you know, you can become idolatrous behavior. So yeah, feel free to log off, switch off. You are missing nothing. If you're on it, let's make sure that we behave in a way which is gracious. If people are horrible to us, it's your opportunity to be kind and gracious back to them. And some basics, really. You know, you wouldn't drive after a glass of wine, so don't tweet after one either. You know, let's be cautious, let's be gracious. Let's surprise people by being kind.
I'm just interested where this is going, because it seems as though the trends are even getting more extreme, aren't they? I mean, TikTok is now
the great new thing, and TikTok is just videos and very short snaps. Is It's as though this whole tendency to reduce life to these little digital snapshots, and yet with an enormous addictive potential. I'm just really interested to try to look forward to the future. Do you see? I mean, in theory, it seems to me, as Christians, we're not against technology, we're not against these kind of advances, but we recognise, we're also not naive. I mean, we recognise that there are enormous evil potential in this kind of technology. And from a spiritual point of view, you know, that evil forces can manipulate and twist and all the rest. Yeah. So the question is, how do we redeem it? How do we take this technology and pull it into a way where it really is reflecting kingdom values, it's doing something that's good, that's positive, that's beneficial?
Well, I think one thing just to say, obviously, you know, the development of technology is moving on at a geometric rate, if you like. It's the leaps and bounds that we're making is just, you know, would be unimaginable to the, you know, the 20-year-old me, even the 30-year-old me. But we're also not to kind of fall into the trap of thinking it's all going terribly, terribly, terribly wrong, or at least any more than any other era. So, you know, the title of my book and my podcast is It's a Mucky Business. Politics is a mucky business, but so is everything else since the fall. And so has every age since the fall, and we haven't to fall into kind of the kind of, if you like, the snobbery of chronology, as C.S. Lewis called it, where we think either that everything's great today and yesterday they were all stupid and backwards, or the opposite, that there was a golden age and that now everything's going terribly wrong. And I think neither of those things are right. As Christians, we need to take the culture as we find it, realize without wanting to be flippant that it all ends really, really well. God's sovereign. And therefore we need not worry. And we will be countercultural in every generation, And our job is just to keep focusing upon Jesus, seeking to live for him, seeking to be gracious, seeking to use the opportunity to share his word. And so, yeah, you know, every platform in existence ever is an opportunity for evil and for good. So we've got to use it for good, haven't we?
Yeah. What do you think about Elon Musk and Twitter? Because so on the one hand, you know, Twitter now is politically and in so many ways such an important part of modern life and modern democratic institutions, and yet it's basically a commercial company designed to make profit, and now it's been taken over by this very eccentric, unusual and vastly wealthy man. What do you think about that? Do you think Twitter should be nationalized? Should it be run like the BBC?
I think that would be nice, but that's not where it's begun. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, I use Twitter a bit in the analogy of it being like your local pub, and the landlord wouldn't allow, or shouldn't, you know, get every right to not allow people to behave badly within it. It's a little bit like your nice local pub being taken over by some big pub company. And you like the pub and you like the people, but
you're not sure about the management.
Yeah, the beer's changing a bit. And you don't like the jukebox. So there comes a point where you think, you know what, we might go to another pub, but for the time being, we'll stay where we are.
I like that. You haven't created your Mastodon account as an escape raft in case you have to bail on Twitter.
I have a feeling we've certainly downloaded all my data just in case. But I mean, you know, that he is a strange man with odd views is one thing. I mean, you know, but he owns it, he can do what he likes with it. And I suppose, yeah, so I would feel sad if it changed dramatically. Maybe as good an analogy as, you know, your football team being taken over by somebody horrible. And that does happen to people. You know, to people who are Newcastle United fans, that sort of, you know, you Manchester City fans, you know, you're all right with this then, are you? And, you know, they're still wearing the blue or the black and white tops, and I mean, I'm a Blackburn Rovers fan, and we're owned by chicken farmers who are all right, but they got no money. We used to be owned by Jack Walker, who was everybody's favourite, you know, club owner, you know, rich and decent, you know, so that's a rarity. But yeah, it's similar to that. You've got to, you know, do you decide to walk away from it? The time being, no.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You've recently brought out a book, which is kind of based, of course, building off your own Premier podcast called A Mucky Business, which we do recommend, which is all about kind of Christians in political life. What's your kind of elevator pitch for that? What's the kind of theological case for skeptical Christians about why we should get stuck into this mucky world?
Well, A Mucky Business, the book, it comes from a hypothesis of mine, which I find from talking to lots of Christians, that many Christians sort of shy away from politics because they think it is a mucky business, a place that is populated by corruption and compromise and sin. On the one hand, that. Secondly, there's also that tendency amongst Christians to think in a slightly otherworldly way and to feel that, well, against the backdrop of eternity, surely political shenanigans are all just a little bit too much small beer and not that important. And then finally, there's a concern, I think, because, I mean, somebody rather dismissively, but I think there's some truth in it, really, flippantly, maybe I should say, described Christianity as the ultimate conspiracy theory. It turns out there is somebody behind everything after all, but they're good, so that's great. But the point is, I think that it comes with that sense Christians have of distrust of human institutions, including the media. And you can perhaps see where I'm going there. They end up with Christians becoming a little bit too susceptible to fake news because of this distrust of what we call the mainstream media, which generally means a professional media, which is better, not necessarily right, but better. And so I wanted to counter all those things. It's not a book aimed at recruiting people to stand for parliament, although that might be a conclusion people might reach, or even to be particularly politically active and put on a rosette and take up a clipboard. It is a plea to Christians just to think wisely about politics, why they should, and why it's a good way of serving people in your community.
What's your experience of other politicians, people, some of whom share your faith, many of whom don't? I mean, it's interesting that, you know, over the years I've had experience of meeting a whole number of politicians, particularly to do with medical ethical type issues. And by and large, my experience has been very positive. I've been really impressed by, you know, the backbench, the sort of your average jobbing backbencher who is genuinely concerned about these issues, wants to engage, is you know, and yet the media portrayal is of this sort of swamp of corruption, of people just sort of, you know, feathering their own beds and, you know, abusing expenses and so on. And I mean, from the inside, what's your perception of what motivates most of your fellow, particularly backbenchers?
It's complicated, is the honest answer, like every other human being. And we're, you know, I think as a Christian, I've definitely settled, at least I think I've settled on the view that the most significant thing Christians can do in politics is to serve people. You know, it might be really boring I don't find it boring, but to report upon it, it might be very boring just to serve your community and to serve your constituents and to look after their interests and be their advocate. It's a hugely motivating thing for me to serve people. I think there's also the fact that we find ourselves in a place where we are we have a profile, and therefore we can share the gospel gently when we get the opportunity to do so. But I wouldn't lie to you and say that's always been my motivation. You know, you find politics interesting, so you get involved in politics. You think you've got a better way of running the world than the other lot, so you try to win the election so you can do that locally and nationally. And then, of course, there's personal ambition. There's the desire to be somebody. I think that, you know, the desire to be liked and loved is not just a functional thing in politics. You want to be elected, you know. It's also something which is deeply psychological. Somebody cruelly, but I dare say possibly truthfully, once said that politics is showbiz for ugly people. We want to be on, we want to be on the telly or on the stage, and we've got no discernible talent. I'll do this. We may not, there might not be a conscious choice like that, but there is. So I said it's complicated, and it is, and it's as complicated for Christians as it is for non-Christians. I come across I've got plenty of Christian friends of all different political persuasions in this place and beyond. And some of them, I really almost feel envious towards them, because I think that there's a real neatness towards their journey into politics. They became Christians. They felt called to go into politics as an outworking of their faith. And that is brilliant. But it's also, it's just as acceptable to be like me. To have got involved in politics before you were a Christian, to often not necessarily have thought too deeply about the marriage between the two and how they relate, and to perhaps have falteringly come to wiser understandings about how you can be a Christian in politics and how you should be later on. We are all mucky people, so no doubt it's a mucky business.
One of the things that really interests me about this question is I totally kind of buy the argument that politics is a mucky business, but so is the rest of the world, and we're not called to kind of retreat into a holy huddle, but to get stuck in. But politics is such a, it is slightly unusual in that as a career to rise up the ranks, to be successful, to be effective, there are a lot of incentives to, you know, bend the truth, to promise the electorate things that you really can't deliver. Do you ever worry about it kind of corrupting you little by little? You know, the whole metaphor of boiling the frog so slowly it doesn't realize it's being boiled, that people go in with kind of good, pure reason, theological motivations, but just the nature of the business without really realizing starts to change them and shape them.
Yes, and I have seen that happen. I think that the answer to all of that, though, is fellowship. It's your walk with God being fresh and something that you are committed to. And so I would say whenever I have the low points as a Christian for me over the 17 and a half years that I've been a member of Parliament have really largely coincided with me, thoughtlessly, needlessly drifting away from fellowship within this place, so that you end up in a situation where it's not that I wasn't going to church or what have you, but there's a kind of separation almost. The people around you in your political life, wonderful, talented, lovely people, but not Christians, most of them. And then, you know, your church family, maybe A, you're not as deeply integrated with them as you should be, and B, you've not taken them on, or I haven't taken them on that journey with me. And so there was a kind of level of disconnect and lack of understanding on both sides. So if you're a Christian in politics, don't do it on your own. Don't do it on your own. Make sure that you are in fellowship and regularly with people who get what it is that you're doing.
What do you make about the problems that female politicians have? Because, you know, if my daughter was considering going, you know, in becoming an MP, I'd be incredibly concerned about her and thinking, you know, why is it that women in particular target this horrendous trolling and abuse, and what can we do about it?
So I there definitely is, if you just look at social media and the, you know, the preponderance of death threats, far more for women than there are for men. And I suspect because frankly, the majority, but by no means all, of death threats and, you know, serious abuse online comes from men, and that those people are cowards. They pick on those they consider to be more vulnerable, and they will consider those to be women. There's this deep misogyny in there. We need to look into our own hearts and repent of any of that that we may have ourselves. And I think that, so I think it's important that, you know, we are a place where, I mean, people in politics shouldn't be protected from being offended and being had a go at and all the rest of it. You know, it's part of the job, but we also shouldn't be in a position where people are made to feel unsafe, and indeed are unsafe. And that's why, you know, as we said in last week's conversation, that, you know, those people who manage and own, you know, these large social media companies need to behave like a responsible pub landlord. And you throw out the people who are glassing people, frankly. It's not, you know, if you're glassing people, you're not exercising your freedom of speech. You're in the police and you're out the door.
This is a northern expression. We just have to explain glassing people.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Even if just, you know, you turn up at a table full of people and you start shouting, you know, sexist abuse at them or what have you, even if you don't resort to glassing them, you know, it's still, you know, it's not, we're not being, you know, nice liberals and champions of free speech. Say, yeah, carry on. You've got that right to do that. Let's not, don't cancel those people. No, do cancel them. Chuck them out.
I wanted to ask, to be happy here, it'd be a shame not to ask in particular about your time as a leader of the Liberal Democrats. You clearly, as you made the case earlier, that there is no kind of bar for Christians to get kind of getting stuck into politics. Do you feel the same about being leaders of political parties? Because I recall when you eventually kind of resigned, you did make the case that you'd found the tension between your evangelical faith and the requirements of the role too much to bear. Is with hindsight, do you think it actually is impossible for Christians in good conscience to have that particular role and scrutiny of being a party leader?
Yes, it can be. And I would say that I found it too difficult. And I could argue that if I'd handled myself more wisely, particularly what I said earlier on about making sure there isn't a disconnect between the very lovely but non-Christian people around you in the role and your Christian family being somewhat innocent to what was going on in that role, then I'd have been far better equipped and we'd have dealt with that sort of scrutiny far, far better and far more wisely. So I found that, you know, basically I was in a situation where I either had to be a bad leader or to, you know, massively, massively compromise my faith in a way which would be unacceptable because of the situation I got myself into. But no, I don't think it's impossible. And I've, you know, I find it a privilege to have, you know, on the quiet, given some advice to people who are aspiring to go as far or further than I did. And that's a real blessing to be able to do that. So no, I think, and then also let's remember, you know, I know it's only the Liberal Democrats, but I got to be the leader of it. I was president of the party for most of the time in coalition. And so, you know, if there is a ceiling for Christians in politics, it's relatively high. And there are Christians in the cabinet at the moment and of leaders of other political parties. And so we should, you know, we should rejoice in that and just remember we've got to be wise. That's all.
Our USP for this podcast is particularly looking in the future and technology and so on. And so, where do you see politics going in terms of technology? You know, one of the really interesting things to me, I'm a bit of a science fiction buff, and it's fascinating, you know, that science fiction has always assumed that as we go towards the future, we're going to end up with world government. The only way that with all this technological advance and all the rest, there's going to have to be world government. There's going to be some kind of, you know, the old nation states are going to collapse and so on. And yet, in reality, it doesn't seem that that's coming anytime soon, doesn't it?
So there's no sign of that. And but I understand to a degree, with some very rare exceptions, global media has an impact everywhere in every corner, even in China, even in Russia, maybe not North Korea. But, you know, there is a sense of people seeing what they could have. And so that does mean that, you know, sovereign states become less sovereign and they can't really govern their own culture, if indeed any government ever really could. So I think there is some movement towards a kind of a global culture, and which I think probably, you know, given what nation states are, might be a precursor to a kind of a global governance. Who knows? But I also think that what I find is that, yes, social media and electronic communications are rife and significant, but they're about connecting people and connecting to people with for whom relationship is important. And so just from a politician point of view, I know that the old traditional ways of communicating are more effective now because of social media, because they contrast and they feel more authentic. Someone turns up on your doorstep, that's more impressive than someone sending you an email or a, you know, a Facebook post. And if someone delivers you a kind of reasonably well-produced bit of paper that goes to the letterbox, I mean, you get so little mail these days, it's not competing with very much. You're much more likely to read it. So I think there is a sense that people hanker after, you know, authentic relationship and communications. It doesn't. So I think that the rise of social media, and I'm sure that the extent to which electronic communications grows and permeates and transforms in its nature, I'm sure that's going to continue. But I don't think it's going to stop us being human and desiring relationship, real relationship.
And it seems to me there's almost a paradoxical shift back towards the local as our horizons get broadened and broadened. I mean, you'll be aware that the pressure from for parties to choose local people to serve, run as MPs is greater than ever before. You know, a generation ago, it was not unusual for lots of MPs, maybe even most of them, not to really be from the areas they represent. And now ordinary British people don't really tolerate that. They demand that their representative knows something of them, lives around the corner, like is a neighbour. That is that a positive thing in your view?
Well, it certainly can be. And it's certainly a thing that we do observe, that we talk about identity politics as a negative. And I broadly think it is. But it's also a consequence of the fact that we have identities, and lots of them are regional or national or family based. And, you know, so there's no doubt that sort of Brexit and the issues over independence in Scotland are to a degree about people's sense of place. And where they feel that they belong, and all of those sorts of things. And so I think that the idea that we're being, you know, merged into a single amorphous blob is unlikely to be true. I think people who don't respect people's identities and try to merge us all into one big mush are destined to fail.
So on the one hand, I can absolutely see this need for localism in a way, and it's a kind of reaction against the massive digital scale. What about the polarization that digital technology seems to enhance? Because this seems to be such a feature. I mean, we in the States, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? The level of toxic polarization and politically, and to a lesser extent, we seem to be suffering from quite a lot of it here, and yet. Surely, you know, in reality, there's a large body of people who are somewhere in the middle, aren't they? And yeah. Why on earth can we not find a way of politics? Now, I suppose this is a party political speech for the Liberal Democrat Party. But
is there a mushy centrist middle ground, perhaps, Tim, we could lean towards?
But just, I'm, you know, there's all this worry about echo chambers, about the outrage and abuse, the way the technology just encourages polarization. Do you see a way forward here?
Yeah, well, let's first of all put things into context. And again, let's not panic about the state of the world and make it worse than it really is and say that things are so much worse than they really were. You know, we've not got, you know, armed gangs of black shirts fighting communists in the streets physically with, you know, with balls and chains and stabbings and all the rest of it. So, we've had intense polarization before, and arguably it's been even worse than it is today. So let's just say that first of all. Secondly, I think one of the issues, and there is a greater polarization, is I talked about identity politics. If we disagree about whether the water companies should be nationalized, we can have quite a heated debate over it all. And during the kind of 60s through to the 90s, maybe even today to a degree, that was the kind of the nature of the debate, you know, the role of the state. And so we have really quite a wild disagreement, but you've not caused personal offence to me if you take a different position to the position that I've taken. But if I say that you're not properly Scottish unless you believe in nationalism and independence, or if I say the opposite to you, I've assaulted you personally. And the same thing goes if I talk about people's right to speak about issues to do with, you know, gender and whether gender is or is not a cultural construct or a biological one. To have that conversation, I have done harm to you. I have caused you deep offence. I've not just disagreed with you on an important issue. I have sought to cancel you as an individual. And so we've got a situation where division becomes personalised. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, privatised and some people say atomised society. And whether it's the result of what she did or whether it's something more, universal, more global, we have become atomized as individuals and we are our own little kings and gods now. And as a result, any disagreement as to, you know, the basis of our identity is deep wounding and offense and must be stopped at all costs.
Well, it's been really fascinating talking to you, Tim. Thanks so much for your time. I'm aware we're running out of time. I need to let you get on to, I think it's health questions, you said. We wouldn't want to interfere in your important role than our legislature. So just before you go, would you mind telling people a bit more about how they can get hold of the book and if they want to find out your podcast, what's the best way of doing that as well?
Well, they're both called A Mucky Business, and they are, first of all, the podcast is on Premier Radio every Tuesday afternoon at drive time, but available from as a podcast. So I think we're at episode 70 or 71 or something like that at the moment, and always feature interviews with politicians and others of great interest from all parties, including former cabinet ministers and former leaders and all the rest of it. And the book, A Mucky Business, which is a team effort done by my colleagues, my friends at Faith in Public. I can tell you more about that another time. But it is available at some good bookshops.
Excellent. Well, do get hold of those if you're interested, and do check out Tim's podcast as well. Lots of really interesting conversations he has with other Christians in politics. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Thanks for joining us, Tim. It's been great to chat. As always, you can get in touch with us by emailing MOLAD, MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. And there's other stuff to read on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. But for now, we'll say goodbye and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.